Yes. Wow. Must have been a crazy bastard. There was a trace of humor in Nate's voice. Nearly 4 months earlier, he'd been found by a maid in a motel room, his stomach full of pills and rum. He left everything to an illegitimate daughter I'd never heard of. Is she married? What does she look like? I want you to go find her.
Me?
Yes. She's lost? We don't know where she is. How much did he... Somewhere around $11 billion before taxes. Does she know it? No. She doesn't even know he's dead. Does she know Troy's her father? I don't know what she knows.
Where is she?
Brazil, we think. She's a missionary working with a remote tribe of Indians. Nate stood and walked around the room.
I spent a week there once, he said. I was in college, or maybe law school. It was Carnival. Naked girls dancing in the streets of Rio, the samba bands, a million people partying all night.
His voice trailed away as the nice little memory surfaced and quickly faded. This is not Carnival.
No, I'm sure it's not. Would you like some coffee?
Yes, black. Nate pressed a button on the wall and announced his order into the intercom. $1,000 a day also covered room service.
How long will I be gone?
He asked, sitting again by the window. It's a wild guess, but I'd say 10 days. There's no hurry, and she might be hard to find.
What part of the country?
Western, near Bolivia. This outfit she works for specializes in sending its people into the jungles where they minister to Indians from the Stone Age. We've done some research, and they seem to take pride in finding the most remote people on the face of the earth.
You want me to first find the right jungle, then hike into it in search of the right tribe of Indians, then somehow convince them that I'm a friendly lawyer from the States and they should help me find a woman who probably doesn't want to be found to begin with.
Something like that.
Might be fun.
Think of it as an adventure.
Plus, it'll keep me out of the office, right, Josh? Is that it, a diversion while you sort things out?
Someone has to go, Nate. A lawyer from our firm has to meet this woman face to face, show her a copy of the will, explain it to her, and find out what she wants to do next. It cannot be done by a paralegal or a Brazilian lawyer.
Why me?
Because everybody else is busy. You know the routine. You've lived it for more than 20 years. Life at the office, lunch at the courthouse, sleep on the train. Plus, it might be good for you.
Are you trying to keep me away from the streets, Josh? Because if you are, then you're wasting your time. I'm clean. Clean and sober. No more bars, no more parties, no more dealers. I'm clean, Josh. Forever.
Josh nodded along because he was certainly expected to. But he'd been there before. I believe you, he said, wanting to very badly.
The porter knocked and brought their coffee on a silver tray. After a while, Nate asked, what about the indictment? I'm not supposed to leave the country until it's wrapped up.
I've talked to the judge, told him it was pressing business. He wants to see you in 90 days.
Is he nice?
He's Santa Claus.
So if I'm convicted, do you think he'll give me a break?
That's a year away. Let's worry about it later.
Nate was sitting at a small table, hunched over his coffee, staring into the cup as he thought of questions. Josh was on the other side, still gazing into the distance.
What if I say no? Nate asked. Josh shrugged, as if it didn't matter. No big deal. We'll find someone else. Think of it as a vacation. You're not afraid of the jungle, are you?
Of course not.
Then go have some fun.
When would I leave?
In a week. Brazil requires a visa, and we'll have to pull some strings. Plus, there are some loose ends around here.
Walnut Hill required at least a week of pre-release, a period of conditioning before it fed its clients back to the wolves. They had been pampered, sobered, brainwashed, and nudged into emotional, mental, and physical shape. Pre-release braced them for the re-entry.
A week, Nate repeated to himself.
About a week, yes.
And it'll take 10 days.
I'm just guessing.
So I'll be down there during the holidays.
I guess it looks that way.
That's a great idea.
You want to skip Christmas?
Yes.
What about your kids?
There were 4 of them, 2 by each wife, 1 in grad school and 1 in college, 2 in middle school. He stirred his coffee with a small spoon and said, "Not a word, Josh. Almost 4 months here, and not a word from any of them." His voice ached, and his shoulders sagged. He looked quite frail for a second.
"I'm sorry," Josh said.
Josh had certainly heard from the families. Both wives had lawyers who'd called to sniff around for money. Nate's oldest child was a grad student at Northwestern who needed tuition money, and he personally had called Josh to inquire not about his father's well-being or whereabouts, but, more important, his father's share of the firm's profits last year. He was cocky and rude, and Josh had finally cursed him.
"I'd like to avoid all the parties and holiday cheer," Nate said, rallying as he got to his bare feet and walked around the room.
"So you'll go? Is it the Amazon?"
"No, it's the Pantanal, the largest wetlands in the world."
"Piranhas, anacondas, alligators?"
"Sure."
"Cannibals?"
"No more than D.C.
"Seriously?"
"I don't think so. They haven't lost a missionary in 11 years.
"What about a lawyer?"
"I'm sure they would enjoy filleting one. Come on, Nate, this is not heavy lifting. If I weren't so busy, I'd love to go. The Pantanal is a great ecological reserve."
"I've never heard of it."
"That's because you stopped traveling years ago. You went into your office and didn't come out."
"Except for rehab."
"Take a vacation. See another part of the world."
Nate sipped coffee long enough to redirect the conversation.
"And what happens when I get back? Do I have my office? Am I still a partner?"
"Is that what you want?"
"Of course," Nate said, but with a slight hesitation.
"Are you sure?"
"What else would I do?"
"I don't know, Nate, but this is your 4th rehab in 10 years. The crashes are getting worse. If you walked out now, you'd go straight to the office and be the world's greatest malpractice litigator for 6 months. You'd ignore the old friends, the old bars, the old neighborhoods, nothing but work, work, work. Before long, you'd have a couple of big verdicts, big trials, big pressure. You'd step it up a notch. After a year, there would be a crack somewhere. An old friend might find you, a girl from another life. Maybe a bad jury gives you a bad verdict. I'd be watching every move, but I can never tell when the slide begins."
"No more slides, Josh. I swear."
"I've heard it before, and I want to believe you. But what if your demons come out again, Nate? You came within minutes of killing yourself last time."
"No more crashes."
"The next one will be the last, Nate. We'll have a funeral and say goodbye and watch them lower you into the ground. I don't want that to happen."
"It won't, I swear."
"Then forget about the office. There's too much pressure there."
The thing Nate hated about rehab was the long periods of silence, or meditation, as Sergio called them. The patients were expected to squat like monks in the semi-darkness, close their eyes, and find inner peace. Nate could do the squatting and all that, but behind the closed eyes he was retrying lawsuits and fighting the IRS and plotting against his ex-wives, and, most important, worrying about the future.
This conversation with Josh was one he'd played out many times. But his smart retorts and quick comebacks failed him under pressure. Almost 4 months of virtual solitude had dulled his reflexes. He could manage to look pitiful, and that was all.
"Come on, Josh. You can't just kick me out.
You've litigated for over 20 years, Nate. That's about average. It's time to move on to something else."
"So I'll become a lobbyist and do lunch with the press secretaries for 1,000 little congressmen."
"We'll find a place for you, but it won't be in the courtroom."
"I'm not good at doing lunch. I want to litigate."
"The answer is no. You can stay with a firm, make a lot of money, stay healthy, take up golf, and life will be good, assuming the IRS doesn't send you away."
For a few pleasant moments, the IRS had been forgotten. Now it was back, and Nate sat down again. He squeezed a small pack of honey into his lukewarm coffee. Sugar and artificial sweeteners couldn't be allowed in a place as healthy as Walnut Hill.
"A couple of weeks in the Brazilian wetlands is beginning to sound good," he said.
"So you'll go?"
"Yes."
Since Nate had plenty of time to read, Josh left him a thick file on the Phelan estate and its mysterious new heir. And there were 2 books on remote Indians of South America. Nate read nonstop for 8 hours, even neglecting dinner. He was suddenly anxious to leave, to begin his adventure. When Sergio checked on him at 10, he was sitting like a monk in the middle of his bed, papers sprawled around him, lost in another world.
"It's time for me to leave," Nate said.
"Yes, it is," Sergio replied.
"I'll start the paperwork tomorrow."
Chapter 9. The infighting grew worse as the Phelan heir spent less time talking to each other and more time in their lawyers' offices. A week passed with no will and no plans to probate. With their fortunes within sight but just out of reach, the heirs became even more agitated. Several lawyers were fired, with more brought in to replace them. Mary Ross Phelan Jackman fired hers because he wasn't charging enough per hour. Her husband was a successful orthopedic surgeon with lots of business interests. He dealt with lawyers every day. Their new one was a fireball named Grit, who made a noisy entrance into the fray at $600 per hour. While the heirs waited, they also incurred massive debt. Contracts were signed for mansions, new cars were delivered, consultants were hired to do such varied things as design pool houses, locate just the right private jet, and give advice on which thoroughbred to purchase. If the heirs weren't fighting, then they were shopping. Ramble was the exception, but only because he was a minor. He hung out with his lawyer, who was certainly incurring debt on behalf of his client. Snowball litigation is often commenced with a race to the courthouse. With Josh Stafford refusing to reveal the will, and at the same time dropping mysterious hints about Troy's lack of testamentary capacity, the lawyers for the Phelan heirs finally panicked. 10 days after the suicide, Hart Geddes went to the Circuit Court of Fairfax County, Virginia, and filed a petition to compel the last will and testament of Troy L. Phelan. With all the finesse of an ambitious lawyer to be reckoned with, he tipped a reporter from the Post. They chatted for an hour after the filing, some comments off the record, others offered for the glory of the lawyer. A photographer took some pictures. Oddly, Hark filed his petition on behalf of all Phelan heirs, and he listed their names and addresses as if they were his clients. He faxed them copies when he returned to his office. Within minutes, his phone lines were burning. The Post story the next morning was complemented by a large photo of Hark frowning and rubbing his beard. The story covered even more space than he'd dreamed of. He read it at sunrise in a coffee shop in Chevy Chase, then hurriedly drove to his new office.
A couple of hours later, just after 9, the circuit court clerk's office in Fairfax County was crawling with lawyers, more so than normal. They arrived in tight little packs, spoke in terse sentences to the clerks, and worked hard at ignoring each other. Their petitions were varied, but they all wanted the same things: recognition in the Phelan matter, and a look at the will. Probate matters in Fairfax County were randomly assigned to one of 6 judges. The Phelan matter landed on the desk of the Honorable F. Parr Wycliffe, age 36, a jurist with little experience but lots of ambition. He was thrilled to get such a high-profile case. Wycliffe's office was in the Fairfax County Courthouse, and throughout the morning he monitored the filings in the clerk's office. His secretary hauled in the petitions, and he read them immediately. When the dust settled below him, he called Josh Stafford to introduce himself. They chatted politely for a few minutes, the usual lawyerly preliminaries, stiff and cautious because weightier matters were coming. Josh had never heard of Judge Wycliffe. "Is there a will?" Wycliffe finally asked. "Yes, Your Honor, there is a will." Josh chose his words carefully. It was a felony in Virginia to hide a will. If the judge wanted to know, then Josh would certainly cooperate. "Where is it?"
"Here in my office."
"Who is the executor?"
"Me."
"When do you plan to probate it?"
"My client asked me to wait until January 15th.
"Hmm. Any particular reason?" There was a simple reason. Troy wanted his greedy children to enjoy one last spending spree before he jerked the rug from under them. It was mean and cruel, vintage Troy.
"I have no idea," Josh said.
"The will is holographic. Mr. Phelan signed it just seconds before he jumped."
"A holographic will?"
"Yes."
"Weren't you with him?"
"Yes, it's a long story."
"Perhaps I should hear it."
"Perhaps you should."
Josh had a busy day. Wycliffe did not, but he made it sound as though every minute were planned. They agreed to meet for lunch, a quick sandwich in Wycliffe's office. Sergio did not like the idea of Nate's trip to South America. After almost 4 months in a highly structured place like Walnut Hill, where the doors and gates were locked and an unseen guard with a gun watched the road a mile down the mountain, and where TV, movies, games, magazines, and phones were heavily monitored, the re-entry into a familiar society was often traumatizing. The notion of a re-entry by way of Brazil was more than troubling. Nate didn't care. He was not at Walnut Hill by court order. Josh had put him there, and if Josh asked him to play hide-and-seek in the jungle, so be it. Sergio could bitch and moan all he wanted. Pre-release turned into a week from hell. The diet changed from no-fat to low-fat, with such inevitable ingredients as salt, pepper, cheese, and a little butter added to prepare his system for the evils out there. Nate's stomach rebelled, and he lost 3 more pounds. "Just an inkling of what's waiting for you down there," Sergio said smugly. They fought during therapy, which was common at Walnut Hill. Skin had to be thickened, edges sharpened. Sergio began to distance himself from his patient. It was usually difficult to say goodbye, and Sergio shortened the sessions and became aloof. With the end in sight, Nate began counting the hours. Judge Wycliffe inquired as to the contents of the will, and Josh politely declined to tell him. They were eating deli sandwiches at a small table in His Honor's small office. The law did not require Josh to reveal what was in the will, at least not now. And Wycliffe was slightly out of bounds to ask, but his curiosity was understandable.
"I'm somewhat sympathetic to the petitioners," he said. "They have a right to know what's in the will. Why delay it?"
"I'm just following my client's wishes," Josh replied.
"You have to probate the will sooner or later."
"Of course."
Wycliffe slid his appointment book up to his plastic plate and gazed down with a squint over his reading glasses.
Today is December 20th. There's no way to assemble everyone before Christmas. How does the 27th look to you?
What do you have in mind?
A reading of the will. The idea struck Josh, and he almost choked on a dill spear. Gather them all together, the Phelans and their entourages and new friends and hangers-on, and all their merry lawyers, and pack them into Wycliffe's courtroom for a reading of the will. Make sure the press knows about it. As he crunched on another bite of pickle and looked at his little black book, he worked hard to suppress a grin. He could hear the gasps and groans, the shock waves, the utter, bitter disbelief, then the muted cursing. Then perhaps a sniffle and maybe a sob or two as the Phelans tried to absorb what their beloved father had done to them. It would be a vicious, glorious, thoroughly unique moment in the history of American law, and Josh suddenly couldn't wait.
"The 27th is fine with me," he said.
"Good. I'll notify the parties as soon as I can identify all of them. There are lots of lawyers."
"It helps if you remember that there are 6 kids and 3 ex-wives, so there are 9 principal sets of lawyers."
"I hope my courtroom is big enough."
"Standing room only," Josh almost said. "People packed together with not a sound as the envelope is opened, the will unfolded, the unbelievable words read."
"I suggest you read the will," Josh said.
Wycliffe certainly intended to. He was seeing the same scene as Josh. It would be one of his finest moments, reading a will that disposed of $11 billion.
"I assume the will is somewhat controversial," the judge said.
"It's wicked."
His Honor actually smiled. Chapter 10 Before his most recent crash, Nate had lived in an aging condo in Georgetown, one he'd leased after his last divorce. But it was gone now, a victim of the bankruptcy. So, literally, there was no place for Nate to spend his first night of freedom. As usual, Josh had carefully planned the release. He arrived at Walnut Hill on the appointed day with a duffel bag filled with new and neatly pressed J. Crew shorts and shirts for the trip south. He had the passport and the visa, plenty of cash, lots of directions and tickets, a game plan, even a first aid kit. Nate never had the chance to be anxious. He said goodbye to a few members of the staff, but most were busy elsewhere because they avoided departures. He walked proudly through the front door after 140 days of wonderful sobriety, clean, tanned, fit, down 17 pounds to 174, a weight he hadn't known in 20 years. Josh drove, and for the first 5 minutes nothing was said. The snow blanketed the pastures, but thinned quickly as they left the Blue Ridge. It was December 22nd. At a very low volume, the radio played carols. "Could you turn that off?" Nate finally said.
"What?
The radio?"
Josh punched a button, and the music he hadn't heard disappeared.
"How do you feel?" Josh asked.
"Could you pull over at the nearest quick stop?"
"Sure. Why?"
"I'd like to get a six-pack."
"Very funny."
"I'd kill for a tall Coca-Cola." They bought soft drinks and peanuts at a country store. The lady at the cash register said a cheery Merry Christmas, and Nate could not respond. Back in the car, Josh headed for Dulles, 2 hours away.
"Your flight goes to Sao Paulo, where you'll lay over 3 hours before catching one to a city called Campo Grande."
"Do these people speak English?"
"No, they're Brazilian. They speak Portuguese."
"Of course they do."
"But you'll find English at the airport."
"How big is Campo Grande?"
"500,000, but it's not your destination. From there, you'll catch a commuter flight to a place called Corumbá. The towns get smaller."
"And so do the airplanes."
"Yes, same as here."
For some reason, the idea of a Brazilian commuter flight is not appealing. Help me here, Josh. I'm nervous.
Either that or a 6-hour bus ride.
Keep talking.
In Corumbá, you'll meet a lawyer named Valdir Ruiz. He speaks English.
Have you talked to him?
Yes.
Could you understand him?
Yes, for the most part. A very nice man. Works for about $50 an hour, if you can believe that.
How big is Corumbá?
90,000.
So they'll have food and water and a place to sleep.
Yes, Nate, you'll have a room. That's more than you can say for here.
Ouch.
Sorry. Do you want to back out?
Yes, but I'm not going to. My goal at this point is to flee this country before I hear jingle bells again. I'd sleep in a ditch for the next 2 weeks to avoid Frosty the Snowman.
Forget the ditch. It's a nice hotel.
What am I supposed to do with Valdir?
He's looking for a guide to take you into the Pantanal.
How? Plane? Helicopter?
Boat, probably. As I understand the area, it's nothing but swamps and rivers.
And snakes? Alligators? Piranhas?
What a little coward you are. I thought you wanted to go.
I do. Drive faster.
Relax.
Josh pointed to a briefcase behind the passenger seat.
Open that, he said. It's your carry-on bag.
Nate pulled and grunted. It weighs a ton. What's in here?
Good stuff.
It was made of brown leather, new but built to look well-used, and large enough to hold a small legal library. Nate sat it on his knees and popped it open.
Toys, he said.
That tiny gray instrument there is the latest high-tech digital phone, Josh said, proud of the things he'd collected. Valdir will have local service for you when you get to Corumbá.
So they have phones in Brazil.
Lots of them. In fact, telecommunications are booming down there. Everybody has a cell phone.
Those poor people. What's this?
A computer.
What the hell for?
It's the latest thing. Look how small.
I can't even read the keyboard.
You can hook it to the phone and actually get your email.
Wow. And I'm supposed to do this in the middle of a swamp, with snakes and alligators watching?
It's up to you.
Josh, I don't even use email at the office.
It's not for you, it's for me. I want to keep up with you. When you find her, I want to know immediately.
What's this?
The best toy in the box. It's a satellite phone. You can use it anywhere on the face of the earth. Keep the batteries charged, and you can always find me.
You just said they had a great phone system.
Not in the Pantanal. It's 100,000 square miles of wetlands with no towns and very few people. That sat phone will be your only means of communication once you leave Corumbá.
Nate opened the hard plastic case and examined the glossy little phone. How much did this cost you? He asked.
Me? Not a dime.
Okay, how much did it cost the Phelan estate?
$4,400. Worth every penny of it.
Do my Indians have electricity?
Nate was flipping through the owner's manual.
Of course not. Then how am I supposed to keep the batteries charged?
There's an extra battery. You'll think of something.
So much for a quiet getaway.
It's going to be very quiet. You'll thank me for the toys when you get there.
Can I thank you now?
No.
Thanks, Josh. For everything.
Don't mention it.
In the crowded terminal at a small table across from a busy bar, they sipped weak espresso and read newspapers. Josh was very conscious of the bar. Nate didn't seem to be. The neon Heineken logo was hard to miss. A tired and skinny Santa Claus ambled by, looking for children to take cheap gifts from his bag. Elvis sang Blue Christmas from a jukebox in the bar. The foot traffic was thick, the noise unnerving, everyone flying home for the holidays.
Are you okay? Josh asked.
Yes, I'm fine. Why don't you leave? I'm sure you have better things to do.
I'll stay.
Look, Josh, I'm fine. If you think I'm waiting for you to leave so I can dash over there to the bar and guzzle vodka, you're wrong. I have no desire for booze. I'm clean and very proud of it.
Josh looked a bit sheepish, primarily because Nate had read his mind. Nate's binges were legendary. If he cracked, there wasn't enough booze in the airport to satisfy him.
I'm not worried about that, he said, lying.
Then go. I'm a big boy.
They said goodbye at the gate, a warm embrace and promises to call almost on the hour. Nate was anxious to settle into his nest in first class. Josh had a thousand things to do at the office. Two small, secret, precautionary steps had been taken by Josh. First, adjacent seats had been booked for the flight. Nate would have the window, the aisle would remain vacant. No sense having some thirsty executive sitting next to Nate swilling scotch and wine. The seats cost over $7,000 each for the round trip, but money was of no concern. Second, Josh had talked at length with an airline official about Nate's rehab. No alcohol was to be served under any circumstances. A letter from Josh to the airline was on board, just in case it had to be produced to convince Nate. A flight attendant served him orange juice and coffee. He wrapped himself in a thin blanket and watched the sprawl of D.C. disappear below him as the Varig airplane climbed through the clouds. There was relief in the escape from Walnut Hill and Sergio, from the city and its grind, from the past troubles with the last wife and the bankruptcy, and from the current mess with the IRS. At 30,000 feet, Nate had almost decided he would never return. But every re-entry was nerve-wracking. The fear of another slide was always there, just beneath the surface. The frightening part now was that there had been so many re-entries he felt like a veteran. Like wives and big verdicts, he could now compare them. Would there always be another one? During dinner, he realized Josh had been working behind the scenes. Wine was never offered. He picked through the food with the caution of one who just spent nearly 4 months enjoying the great lettuces of the world until a few days ago. No fat, butter, grease, or sugar. The last thing he wanted was a queasy stomach. He napped briefly, but he was tired of sleeping. As a busy lawyer and late-night prowler, he'd learned to live with little sleep. The first month at Walnut Hill, they'd drugged him with pills, and he'd slept 10 hours a day. He couldn't fight them if he were in a coma. He assembled his toys in the empty seat next to him and began reading his collection of owner's manuals. The satellite phone intrigued him, though it was difficult to believe he would actually be forced to use it. Another phone caught his attention. It was the latest technical gadget in air travel, a sleek little device practically hidden in the wall next to his seat. He grabbed it and called Sergio at home. Sergio was having a late dinner, but happy to hear from him nonetheless.
"Where are you?" he asked.
"In a bar," Nate replied, his voice low because the lights in the cabin were down.
"Very funny."
"I'm probably over Miami, with 8 hours to go. Just found this phone on board and wanted to check in."
"So you're okay?"
"I'm fine. Do you miss me?"
"Not yet. You miss me?
Are you kidding? I'm a free man, flying off to the jungle for a marvelous adventure. I'll miss you later, okay?"
"Okay.
And you'll call if you get in trouble?"
"No trouble, Serge. Not this time."
"Attaboy, Nate."
"Thanks, Serge.
Don't mention it. Just call me." A movie started, but no one was watching. The flight attendant brought more coffee. Nate's secretary was a long-suffering woman named Alice who'd cleaned up after him for almost 10 years. She lived with her sister in an old house in Arlington. He called her next. They'd spoken once in the past 4 months. The conversation lasted for half an hour. She was delighted to hear his voice and learned that he'd been released. She knew nothing about his trip to South America, which was a bit odd, because she normally knew everything. But she was reserved on the phone, even cautious.
Nate, the trial lawyer, smelled a rat and attacked as if on cross-examination. She was still in litigation, still at the same desk, doing pretty much the same thing but for a different lawyer.
Who? Nate demanded.
A new guy. A new litigator. Her words were deliberate, and Nate knew that she had been fully briefed by Josh himself. Of course, Nate would call her as soon as he was released. Which office was the new guy in? Who was his paralegal? Where did he come from? How much medical malpractice had he done? Was her assignment with him just temporary? Alice was sufficiently vague.
"Who's in my office?" he asked.
"No one. It hasn't been touched. Still has little stacks of files in every corner."
"What's Carrie doing?"
"Staying busy, waiting for you."
Carrie was Nate's favorite paralegal.
Alice had all the right answers, while revealing little. She was especially mum about the new litigator.
"Get ready," he said as the conversation ran out of steam. "It's time for a comeback."
"It's been dull, Nate."
He hung up slowly and played back her words. Something was different. Josh was quietly rearranging his firm. Would Nate get lost in the shuffle? Probably not. But his courtroom days were over. He would worry about it later, he decided. There were so many people to call, and so many phones to do it with. He knew a judge who'd kicked booze 10 years earlier, and he wanted to check in with his wonderful report from rehab. His first ex-wife deserved a blistering call, but he wasn't in the mood. And he wanted to phone all four of his children and ask why they hadn't called or written. Instead, he took a folder from his case and began reading about Mr. Troy Phelan and the business at hand. At midnight, somewhere over the Caribbean, Nate drifted away. Chapter 11. An hour before dawn, the plane began its descent. He had slept through breakfast, and when he awoke, a flight attendant hurriedly brought coffee. The city of Sao Paulo appeared, an enormous sprawl that covered almost 800 square miles. Nate watched the sea of lights below and wondered how one city could hold 20 million people. In a rush of Portuguese, the pilot said good morning, and then several paragraphs of greetings that Nate missed entirely. The English translation that followed was not much better. Surely he wouldn't be forced to point and grunt his way across the country. The language barrier caused a short bout of anxiety, but it ended when a pretty Brazilian flight attendant asked him to buckle his seatbelt. The airport was hot and swarming with people. He collected his new duffel bag, walked it through customs without so much as a glance from anyone, and rechecked it on Varig to Campo Grande. Then he found a coffee bar with the menu on the wall. He pointed and said, "Espresso," and the cashier rang him up. She frowned at his American money, but changed it anyway. One Brazilian real equaled one American dollar. Nate now owned a few reais. He sipped the coffee while standing shoulder to shoulder with some rowdy Japanese tourists. Other languages flew around him, German and Spanish mixing with the Portuguese coming over the loudspeakers. He wished he'd bought a phrase book so he could at least understand a word or two. Isolation settled in, slowly at first. In the midst of multitudes, he was a lonely man. He didn't know a soul. Almost no one knew where he was at that moment, and damned few people cared. Cigarette smoke from the tourists boiled around him, and he walked quickly away into the main concourse where he could see the ceiling 2 levels above and the ground floor below. He began walking through the crowds, aimlessly, carrying the heavy briefcase, cursing Josh for filling it with so much junk. He heard loud English and drifted toward it. Some businessmen were waiting near the United counter, and he found a seat near them. It was snowing in Detroit, and they were anxious to get home for Christmas. A pipeline had brought them to Brazil, and before long Nate tired of their drivel. They cured whatever homesickness he felt. He missed Sergio. After the last rehab, the clinic had placed Nate in a halfway house for a week to ease the re-entry. He hated the place and the routine, but with hindsight, the idea had merit. He needed a few days to get reoriented. Maybe Sergio was right. He called him from a payphone and woke him up. It was 6:30 in Sao Paulo, but only 4:30 in Virginia. Sergio didn't mind. It went with the territory. There were no first-class seats on the flight to Campo Grande, nor any empty ones. Nate was pleasantly surprised to observe that every face was behind the morning news, and a wide variety of papers at that. The dailies were as slick and modern as any in the States, and they were being read by people who had a thirst for the news. Perhaps Brazil wasn't as backward as he thought. These people could read. The airliner, a 727, was clean and newly refurbished. Coca-Cola and Sprite were on the drink cart. He almost felt at home. Sitting by the window, 20 rows back, he ignored the memo on Indians in his lap and admired the countryside below. It was vast and lush and green, rolling with hills, dotted with cattle farms, and crisscrossed with red dirt roads. The soil was a vivid burnt orange, and the roads ran haphazardly from one small settlement to the next. Highways were virtually non-existent. A paved road appeared, and there was traffic. The plane descended, and the pilot welcomed them to Campo Grande. There were tall buildings, a crowded downtown, the obligatory soccer field, lots of streets and cars, and every residence had a red-tiled roof. Thanks to the typical big firm efficiency, he possessed a memo, one no doubt prepared by the greenest of associates, working at $300 an hour, in which Campo Grande was analyzed as if its presence were crucial to the matters at hand. 600,000 people, a center for cattle trade, lots of cowboys, rapid growth, modern conveniences. Nice to know, but why bother? Nate would not sleep there. The airport seemed remarkably small for a city its size, and he realized he was comparing everything to the United States. This had to stop. When he stepped from the plane, he was hit with the heat. It was at least 90 degrees. 2 days before Christmas, and it was sweltering in the southern hemisphere. He squinted in the brilliance of the sun and descended the steps with a firm hand on the guardrail. He managed to order lunch in the airport restaurant, and when it was brought to his table, he was pleased to see that it was something he could eat. A grilled chicken sandwich in a bun he'd never seen before, with fries as crisp as those in any fast food joint in the States. He ate slowly while watching the runway in the distance. Halfway through lunch, a twin-engine turboprop of Air Pantanal landed and taxied to the terminal. 6 people got off. He stopped chewing as he wrestled with a sudden attack of fear. Commuter flights were the ones you read about and saw on CNN, except that no one back home would ever hear about this one if it went down. But the plane looked sturdy and clean, even somewhat modern, and the pilots were well-dressed professionals. Nate continued eating. "Think positive," he told himself. He roamed the small terminal for an hour. In a news shop, he bought a Portuguese phrase book and began memorizing words. He read travel ads for adventures into the Pantanal. Ecotourism, it was called in English. There were cars for rent, a money exchange booth, a bar with beer signs and whiskey bottles lined on a shelf. And near the front entrance was a slender artificial Christmas tree with a solitary string of lights. He watched them blink to the tune of some Brazilian carol, and despite his efforts not to, Nate thought of his children. It was the day before Christmas Eve. Not all memories were painful. He boarded the plane with teeth clenched and spine stiffened, then slept for most of the hour it took to reach Corumbá. The small airport there was humid and packed with Bolivians waiting for a flight to Santa Cruz. They were laden with boxes and bags of Christmas gifts. He found a cab driver who spoke not a word of English, but it didn't matter. Nate showed him the words Palace Hotel on his travel itinerary, and they sped away in an old, dirty Mazda. Corumbá had 90,000 people, according to yet another memo prepared by Josh's staff. Situated on the Paraguay River on the Bolivian border, it had long since declared itself to be the capital of the Pantanal. River traffic and trade had built the city and kept it going. Through the heat and swelter of the back of the taxi, Corumbá appeared to be a lazy, pleasant little town. The streets were paved and wide and lined with trees. Merchants sat in the shade of their storefronts waiting for customers and chatting with each other. Teenagers darted through traffic on scooters. Barefoot children ate ice cream at sidewalk tables. As they approached the business district, cars bunched together and stopped in the heat. The driver mumbled something but was not particularly disturbed. The same driver in New York or D.C. would have been near the point of violence. But it was Brazil, and Brazil was in South America. The clocks ran slower. Nothing was urgent. Time was not as crucial. "Take off your watch," Nate told himself. Instead, he closed his eyes and breathed the heavy air. The Palace Hotel was in the center of downtown, on a street that descended slightly toward the Paraguay River, sitting majestically in the distance. He gave the cabbie a handful of reais and waited patiently for his change. He thanked him in Portuguese, a feeble obrigado. The cabbie smiled and said something he didn't understand. The doors to the lobby were open, as were all doors facing the sidewalks of Corumbá. The first words he heard upon entering were being yelled by someone from Texas. A band of roughnecks was in the process of checking out. They had been drinking and were in a festive mood, anxious to get home for the holidays. Nate took a seat near a television and waited for them to clear. His room was on the 8th floor. For $18 a day, he got a 12x12 with a narrow bed very close to the floor. If it had a mattress, it was quite thin. No box springs to speak of. There were a desk with a chair, a window unit of AC, a small refrigerator with bottled water, colas, and beer, and a clean bathroom with soap and plenty of towels. Not bad, he told himself. This was an adventure. Not the Four Seasons, but certainly livable. For half an hour, he tried to call Josh. But the language barrier stopped him. The clerk at the front desk knew enough English to find an outside operator, but from there the Portuguese took over. He tried his new cell phone, but the local service had not been activated. At noon, December 23rd, Nate stretched his tired body the length of his flimsy little bed and went to sleep. Valdir Ruiz was a short man with a tiny waist, light brown skin, a small, slick head missing most of the hair, except for a few strands he kept oiled and combed back. His eyes were black and bunched with wrinkles, the result of 30 years of heavy smoking. He was 52, and at the age of 17 he'd left home to spend a year with a family in Iowa as a Rotary exchange student. He was proud of his English, though he didn't use it much in Corumbá. He watched CNN and American television most nights in an effort to stay sharp. After the year in Iowa, he went to college in Campo Grande, then law school in Rio. He reluctantly returned to Corumbá to work in his uncle's small law firm and to care for his aging parents. For more years than he cared to count, Valdir had endured the languid pace of advocacy in Corumbá while dreaming of what might have been in the big city. But he was a pleasant man, happy with life in the way most Brazilians tend to be. He worked efficiently in his small office, just himself and a secretary who answered the phone and did the typing. Valdir liked real estate, the deeds and contracts and such. He never went to court, primarily because courtrooms were not an integral part of practicing law in Brazil. Trials were rare. American-style litigation had not found its way south. In fact, it was still confined to the 50 states. Valdir marveled at the things lawyers did and said on CNN. Why do they clamor for the attention, he often asked himself. Lawyers staging press conferences and hustling from one talk show to the next, chatting about their clients. It was unheard of in Brazil. His office was 3 blocks from the Palace Hotel, on a wide, shaded lot his uncle had bought decades earlier. Thick trees covered the roof, so regardless of the heat, Valdir kept his windows open. He liked the gentle noise from the street. At 3:15, he saw a man he'd never seen before stop and examine his office. The man was obviously a stranger and an American. Valdir knew it was Mr. O'Reilly. The secretary brought them cafezinho, the strong, sugary black coffee Brazilians drink all day in tiny cups, and Nate was instantly addicted to it. He sat in Valdir's office, already on a first-name basis, and admired the surroundings. The squeaky ceiling fan above them, the open windows with the muted sounds of the street drifting in, the neat rows of dusty files on the shelves behind Valdir, the scuffed and worn plank floor under them. The office was quite warm, but not uncomfortable. Nate was sitting in a movie, one shot 50 years ago. Valdir phoned D.C. and got Josh. They talked for a moment, then he handed the phone across the desk. "Hello, Josh," Nate said. Josh was obviously relieved to hear his voice. Nate recounted his journey to Corumbá with emphasis on the fact that he was doing well, still sober, and looking forward to the rest of his adventure. Valdir busied himself with a file in a corner, trying to appear as if he had no interest in the conversation, but absorbing every word. Why was Nate O'Reilly so proud of being sober? When the phone call was over, Valdir produced and unfolded a large air navigational map of the state of Mato Grosso do Sul, roughly the same size as Texas, and pointed to the Pantanal. It covered the entire northwestern portion of the state and continued into Mato Grosso to the north and Bolivia to the west. Hundreds of rivers and streams spread like veins through the swampland. It was shaded yellow and there were no towns or cities in the Pantanal. No roads or highways. 100,000 square miles of swamp, Nate recalled from the innumerable memos Josh had packed for him. Valdir lit a cigarette as they studied the map. He had done some homework. There were 4 red X's along the western edge of the map near Bolivia.
"There are tribes here," he said, pointing to the red marks. "Guato and Ipicas."
"How large are they?" Nate asked, leaning close, his first real glimpse at the terrain he was expected to comb in search of Rachel Lane.
"We don't really know," Valdir replied, his words very slow and precise.
He was trying hard to impress the American with his English.
100 years ago there were many more, but the tribes grow smaller with each generation.
How much contact do they have with the outside world? Nate asked.
Very little. Their culture hasn't changed in 1,000 years. They trade some with the river boats, but they have no desire to change.
Do we know where the missionaries are?
It's difficult to say. I talked with the Minister of Health for the state of Mato Grosso do Sul. I know him personally, and his office has a general idea of where the missionaries are working. I also spoke with a representative from FUNAI. It's our Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Valdir pointed to 2 of the X's.
These are Guato. There are probably missionaries around here.
Do you know their names? Nate asked, but it was a throwaway question. According to a memo from Josh, Valdir had not been given the name of Rachel Lane. He had been told that the woman worked for World Tribes, but that was it.
Valdir smiled and shook his head. That would be too easy. You must understand that there are at least 20 different American and Canadian organizations with missionaries in Brazil. It's easy to get into our country, and it's easy to move around, especially in the undeveloped areas. No one really cares who's out there and what they're doing.
We figure if they're missionaries, then they are good people.
Nate pointed at Korumba, then to the nearest red X. How long does it take to get from here to there?
Depends. By plane, about an hour. By boat, from 3 to 5 days.
Then where's my plane?
It's not that easy, Valdir said, reaching for another map. He unrolled it and pressed it on top of the first one. This is a topographical map of the Pantanal. These are the fazendas.
The what?
Fazendas. Large farms.
I thought it was all swamp.
No. Many areas are elevated just enough to raise cattle. The fazendas were built 200 years ago and are still worked by the Pantaneiros. Only a few of the fazendas are accessible by boat, so they use small airplanes. The airstrips are marked in blue.
Nate noticed that there were very few airstrips near the Indian settlements.
Valdir continued, "Even if you flew into the area, you would then have to use a boat to get to the Indians."
"How are the airstrips?"
They're all grass. Sometimes they cut the grass, sometimes they don't. The biggest problem is cows.
Cows?
Yes. Cows like grass. Sometimes it's hard to land because the cows are eating the runway.
Valdir said this with no effort at humor. Can't they move the cows?
Yes, if they know you're coming. But there are no phones.
No phones in the fazendas?
None. They're very isolated.
So, I couldn't fly into the Pantanal, then rent a boat to find the Indians?
No, the boats are here in Korumba, as are the guides.
Nate stared at the map, especially the Paraguay River, as it wound and looped its way northward in the direction of the Indian settlements. Somewhere along the river, hopefully in proximity to it, in the midst of this vast wetlands, was a simple servant of God, living each day in peace and tranquility, thinking little of the future, quietly ministering to her flock. And he had to find her.
"I'd like to at least fly over the area," Nate said.
Valdir re-rolled the last map.
"I can arrange an airplane and a pilot."
"What about a boat?"
"I'm working on that. This is the flood season, and most of the boats are in use. The rivers are up. There is more river traffic this time of the year."
How nice of Troy to kill himself during the flood season. According to the firm's research, the rains came in November and lasted until February, and all of the lowest areas and many of the fazendas were under water.
"I must warn you, though,"
Valdir said, lighting another cigarette as he refolded the first map,
"air travel is not without risk. The planes are small, and if there's engine trouble, well..."
His voice trailed away as he rolled his eyes and shrugged as if all hope was lost.
"Well, what? There's no place for an emergency landing. No place to put it down. A plane went down a month ago. They found it near a riverbank surrounded by alligators."
"What happened to the passengers?" Nate asked, terrified of the answer.
"Ask the alligators."
"Let's change the subject.
More coffee?"
"Yes, please." Valdir yelled at his secretary. They walked to a window and watched the traffic.
"I think I have found a guide," he said.
"Good. Does he speak English?"
"Yes, very well. He's a young man, just out of the army. A fine boy. His father was a river pilot."
"That's nice." Valdir walked to his desk and picked up the phone. The secretary brought Nate another small cup of cafezinho, and he sipped it standing in the window. Across the street was a small bar with three tables on the sidewalk under a canopy. A red sign advertised Antarctica beer. Two men in shirt sleeves and ties shared a table with a large bottle of Antarctica between them. It was a perfect setting, a hot day, a festive mood, a cold drink enjoyed by two friends in the shade. Nate was suddenly dizzy. The beer sign blurred, the scene came and went, then came back as his heart pounded and his breathing stopped. He touched the windowsill to steady himself.
His hand shook so he placed the cafezinho on a table. Valdir was behind him, oblivious, rattling away in Portuguese. Sweat popped out in neat rows above his eyebrows. He could taste the beer. The slide was beginning, a chink in the armor, a crack in the dam. A rumbling in the mountain of resolve he'd built the last 4 months with Sergio. Nate took a deep breath and collected himself. The moment would pass. He knew it would. He'd been here before, many times now. He picked up the coffee and sipped it furiously as Valdir was hanging up and announcing that the pilot was hesitant to fly anywhere on Christmas Eve. Nate returned to his seat under the squeaking fan. "Offer him some more money," he said. Valdir had been informed by Mr. Josh Stafford that money was no object during this mission.
"He'll call me back in an hour," he said.
Nate was ready to leave. He produced his brand new cell phone, and Valdir walked him through the procedure of finding an AT&T operator who spoke English. As a test, he dialed Sergio and got his answering machine. Then he dialed Alice, his secretary, and wished her a Merry Christmas. The phone worked fine. He was very proud of it. He thanked Valdir and made his way out of the office. They would talk again before the day was over. He walked toward the river, down just a few blocks from Valdir's, and found a small park where workers were busy arranging chairs for a concert. The late afternoon was humid. His shirt was stained with sweat and stuck to his chest. The little episode back at Valdir scared him more than he cared to admit. He sat on the edge of a picnic table and gazed at the great Pantanal lying before him. A mangy teenager appeared from nowhere and offered to sell him marijuana. It was in tiny bags in a small wooden box. Nate waved him off. Maybe in another life. A musician began tuning his guitar, and a crowd slowly gathered as the sun sank over the Bolivian mountains not far away. Chapter 12. The money worked. The pilot reluctantly agreed to fly, but insisted that they leave early and be back in Corumbá by noon. He had small children, an angry wife, and it was, after all, Christmas Eve.